Hello, and welcome to the audio edition of Beastly Business, the first in a series of animal behavior, human-animal bond mysteries, written and read by Myrna Milani. Chapter 23. After McCarthy left, so many thoughts boiled through my mind that I couldn't make any sense of any of them. The same logical brain cells that had told me not to trust him from the beginning crowed joyfully. See, the sadistic bastard locked your car and stole your keys. Then he followed you home just to scare the shit out of you. However, then an equal number of not at all logical cells reminded me that he did get the potentially incriminating samples. And he did return them. Oh, yeah, I almost forgot, sneered the seat of logic. He said he got them from the goat guy whose son owns a trained attack dog, a real pillar of transgenic virtue. No doubt he and McCarthy went to spook you together. Don't be so sarcastic, chirped a mental voice I envisioned belonging to someone with wings. No matter where the samples came from, we got them back, didn't we? I found that chirped we a particularly troublesome indicator of my mental health, no matter how exalted the status of the chirper. Stop it! You're making me crazy! I shouted, much to the surprise of the sleeping pets. Oh, sorry, I apologized to Teresa, who inevitably looks guilty when awakened from a sound sleep. I then silently told myself I'd better do something concrete before I really lost my mind, if I hadn't already. But what? As I reviewed all that had happened since Monica's death, I came to the same conclusion I had several days previously. I needed to learn more about DeWitt's Rottweiler and the Winthrop's Golden before I could determine which one of my canine suspects, if any, had killed my client. If McCarthy had told me the truth, and Douglas DeWitt did bring his dog back to the lake, then it made sense to see that animal before moving on to Jason Winthrop. By the time I walked back to the lake and sat in my car, I decided simply to go see Douglas DeWitt without any great plan, since my great plans hadn't worked out that well anyway. When I pulled up beside his cottage, I saw his vehicle, but no sign of him or the dog. But as soon as I got out of the car, DeWitt stepped out of the cottage and firmly planted himself in front of the door. "May I help you?" Once again, a subtle current of fear permeated his stiff, formal greeting. "I spoke to Nick Cooper and your mom about your dog, and wanted to learn some more about him," I truthfully told him. "Chan told me you might be coming." Douglas DeWitt tossed out that comment so dully, I found myself thinking about toxic substances in Somerset Lake again. "Excuse me?" "Chandler McCarthy. He's a friend of the family. He called a little while ago and told me you'd probably be coming to see me." The fearful undercurrent grew more pronounced, and DeWitt shifted his body in his doorway, as if to protect his home from me. "May I see your dog?" I no longer felt at all that convinced that I actually wanted to see the Rottweiler, but I hoped the request might loosen up his owner a little. "He's not here." DeWitt looked over my head as he spewed the bold-faced lie. "I told you, he's in Massachusetts." "Too bad." I hoped my fake smile radiated a pleasantness I certainly didn't feel. "Nick Cooper said such nice things about him, and I'd look forward to meeting him." I then treated Douglas DeWitt to the middle-aged matron's version of a bold-faced lie. Sagging suddenly against the porch railing, I commenced rapidly fanning myself. "Oh, dear," I whimpered. I think I'm having a hot flash. May I have a glass of water, please?" The young man looked horrified, as males inevitably do under such circumstances, and scurried into the cottage, no doubt fearing I was about to do some disgusting female thing on his doorstep. I scurried right in after him, and had settled into his well-worn couch by the time he returned with the water. In fact, after I spotted an old computer, even more ancient dot matrix printer, and box of pale green paper wedged behind a chair in one corner, I thought I did a marvelous job appearing distressed. That's much better, I gushed gratefully, after barely wetting the tip of my tongue with a potentially mind-rotting Somerset Lake effluent. Now tell me about your dog. How did you get interested in Schutzhund? Most people don't even know it exists. This time I beamed him a professional smile, so richly suffused with implied menopausal symptoms, it practically guaranteed any male under 70 would comply. I had no doubts it would work on Douglas DeWitt. I first heard about it from Jeff Weintraub and Hal Winthrop, he revealed, further confirming his previous statement that McCarthy had ordered him to level with me, about this particular subject at least. We all got our dogs around the same time, and Hal was having trouble training his. Jason has Schutzhund training? I thought I succeeded moderately well in keeping the astonishment out of my voice. Douglas DeWitt negated that possibility with a purposeful shake of his head. No. Hal only lasted 2 sessions and Jeff not much longer. The young man actually established eye contact when he grinned nervously. Neither of them's very consistent. Hal talked about some private lessons, but I don't think anything ever came of it. The dog certainly doesn't act like it did, I interjected dryly as I recalled my meeting with the exuberant Golden. But you continued the training? DeWitt's grin instantly faded and the vigilant look returned. He nodded assent and glanced furtively at the pile of training books on the table in front of me. I'm thinking about quitting. The firmness in his voice startled me. How come, when you're doing so well? It's the attack part. After Monica... He stopped and started over. She told me it was wrong to teach a dog to do that, that some innocent person could get hurt. You have any idea why she felt that way? He shook his head gloomily. She seemed to understand and totally agree with the purpose of the program when I first started talking about it, but then all of a sudden she changed her mind. Your mother told me your dog cut his ear pretty badly. I deliberately changed the subject to catch the young man off guard. The result was sudden and dramatic. A wave of panic swept across DeWitt's face, and he clutched the slender arms of his wooden chair so tightly I feared they'd snap under the strain. He took off the day Monica died, and evidently tangled with some barbed wire. His voice wavered slightly, but I couldn't decide whether that undermined or enhanced his credibility. A Schutzhund dog taking off? I gently proposed the apparent contradiction. We were outside playing and the phone rang, the young technician explained, releasing the chair and rubbing his hands together nervously. My dad called about a serious problem at work, and that tied me up for a while. To tell you the truth, I forgot all about him. How long was he gone? Douglas DeWitt looked like he desperately wanted to lie, but I pinioned him with my gaze in my most McCarthy-esque manner. About half an hour. He admitted so softly I had difficulty hearing him. Maybe 45 minutes. I realized I'd been holding my breath and let it out slowly. Then I immediately and sharply drew it back in when what sounded like a faint whisper of panting drifted over me from somewhere behind. But I couldn't pinpoint its location without turning around. In an attempt to abort the fear elicited by the image of a Rottweiler half-trained to attack staring at the back of my neck, I allowed my eyes to roam the room, looking at anything but the incriminating pile of books. That technique worked, until my eyes fell on the almost hidden printer again. Feeling my own composure rapidly disintegrating, I began flapping my hands in front of my face again and excused myself to go home for a nap. Relief flooded Douglas DeWitt's features as he bid me goodbye. Once away from the cottage's troubling atmosphere, I quickly recovered and added DeWitt's revelation to what I already knew. First, I was convinced that Monica's sudden aversion to Schutzhund was the result of Jeff Weintraub sicking Sabrina on her at Nick Cooper's. Second, if DeWitt really did spend half an hour or longer on the phone with his father, I bet his father called to tell him about the goat and Dad had stolen the evening before. If that call occurred, then it conceivably could have occurred around the time that Monica was killed. But while the dog could have been wandering around innocently cutting his ear during the interval, that didn't explain DeWitt's printer. Why would he threaten me, unless he had something serious to hide? But why would DeWitt deliberately command his dog to attack Monica? Not only one possible answer, but three simultaneously hit me. The girl of his dreams was having a questionable relationship with her dog, in love with another man, and had stolen a multi-million-dollar goat whose loss could cost his father his job. Knowledge of any one of these could have tipped the lovesick young man and devoted son over the edge. I next envisioned Douglas DeWitt searching for some piece of incriminating evidence in Joe's cottage the previous evening. Perhaps the missing data? I could think of no reason why he couldn't have done that, or why his dog couldn't have harassed me afterward. Unless, of course, he lied to McCarthy about bringing the dog back yesterday. But I could easily prove that one way or another. I pulled over, got out of the car, and quickly made my way through the woods toward Douglas DeWitt's cottage, prepared to wait as long as necessary to confirm the identity of the concealed panther in his bedroom. But for once, our lady of bungling dog detectives smiled down on me. As I peered through the thick barrier of shrubbery surrounding the cottage, I saw the young man and an enormous Rottweiler sitting side by side on the shabby dock. Even from a distance, I could see the neat row of sutures on the dog's shaved right ear. You've been listening to an excerpt from Beastly Business, an animal behavior and human-animal bond mystery written by veterinary ethologist Myrna Milani. For more podcasts, commentaries, books on animal behavior and the human-animal bond, and links to behavioral and bond sites, check out my website at mm@mmilani.com. For more specific information, feel free to email me at mm@mmilani.com. All rights related to the book Beastly Business in any form are retained by Myrna Milani. The background music in The Steppes of Central Asia by Alexander Bordin is used with permission of Katova Arts, www.katova.com.